Exciting conference. So the work I'll describe today is a novel approach to the early universe that we call the pseudo-conformal universe. This is work done with Kurt Hinterbickler, who's here. And the results I'm going to present have appeared in a preprint about a month ago. And towards the end of the talk, I'll describe some work in progress. So to echo what... So I think, in general, we all agree that the critical question of early universe cosmology is to explain what physics of the early universe gave rise to these primordial perturbations that we observe, say, in the CMB. And to echo what Neil said about these perturbations, I think a striking feature of them is that they're incredibly simple. You only need a couple of parameters to describe completely their statistical properties so far. And so, to me, what this might hint to is that perhaps there's some underlying symmetry principle that governs the origin of these perturbations. So let me begin with a general result, the theorem. If I just ask a phenomenological question, which is, what kind of early universe physics, what kind of cosmological phases could give rise to perturbations with these properties? So this is a completely phenomenological question, and I want to state a very powerful result, a theorem, as to the possibilities for the early universe. And this result, I should say, is based on a series of papers. In particular, a paper with Godfrey Miller, who's my graduate student who's here, and work by Leonardo Senatore and collaborators. And the theorem is as follows. So if you just have a single scalar field or single degree of freedom active in the early universe, and also assuming that the background cosmology that it generates is a dynamical attractor in a way that I can make precise, then inflation is the unique mechanism that can give rise to perturbations that are scale invariant and Gaussian over a broad range of scales in a way that I can make precise. So these perturbations have these properties over many decades in K space. So the theorem, the first part of the proof, in some sense, is the result of the paper with Godfrey. So if you assume, for simplicity, that the sound speed of your fluid or the scalar field is unity, okay, then the combined requirements of having a scale invariant spectrum and that the background is a dynamical attractor forces you to only two possibilities. First possibility, of course, is inflation. We're used to that one. The second possibility is a phase that we call adiabatic ekpyrosis, which is a mechanism that Paul Steinhardt and I proposed about a year ago. This is a phase in which the scale factor is essentially constant. It corresponds to either a slowly contracting universe or a slowly expanding universe. But meanwhile, the equation of state is dramatically rising in time as tau goes to zero. Okay. These two phases, despite being completely different, actually yield identical power spectra, okay, indistinguishable at the level of the two-point function. These are the only possibilities under the assumption of unit sound speed. However, the degeneracy is broken at the three-point level. Okay, so if you consider non-Gaussianities, because in this case, in the adiabatic periodic case, you have a strongly time-dependent equation of state, this translates into an FNL parameter, which is strongly scale-dependent. And as a result, since FNL grows large on very small scales, eventually you hit a point where your theory is strongly coupled or the non-Gaussianities are too large. So at the end of the day, you can produce a finite range of modes, in this case, 10 to the 5 modes in K-space, which are both scale invariant and Gaussian. Okay. That's the statement. Now, in recent work, we've actually, in recent work with my student Austin Joyce, we've actually extended this statement to cases where your fluid has arbitrary sound speed, arbitrary time-dependent sound speed. So this is completely general, including models that have attracted a lot of interest recently that go back to the work of Christian on models that have very large sound speed. Okay, so the theorem seems to apply here as well. So at the level of single field, it seems inflation is the only robust mechanism under a set of assumptions. So the model I'm going to describe today actually circumvents this theorem by relying on having multi-fields. There's going to be many fields. Now, of course, if I have multi-fields, then there's a lot more freedom to get scale invariant spectrum, because I can always, say I have a scalar field phi, it undergoes some time dependence. I can always rig up some coupling f of phi to some other scalar field chi in such a way that the spectator field will get a scale invariant spectrum. I can always do that. Okay. Now, in practice, that's not so easy to do in the following sense. All of the models that I'm aware of, at least maybe some people can correct me, all the non-inflationary multi-field mechanisms generically have some instability associated with them. So as you try to amplify perturbations in the second field, this is associated with some tachyonic instability, which means that the background is not an attractor. And this was illustrated yesterday in the talk by Jean-Luc Lenners, in this entropic mechanism in which indeed there is some tachyonic direction. Now, as Jean-Luc says, there might be some very nice features associated with having an instability, but it is a feature of these non-inflationary mechanisms. And also, in general, choosing some f of phi, of course, would not, in general, it's not protected by any symmetry considerations. So what's motivating these, you know, some generic f of phi? So the model I'm going to describe in this talk actually at least goes some way in solving, or at least solving these problems in the sense that the mechanism will be an attractor even with these multi-fields, and it will be governed by symmetries. Okay, so what is a pseudo-conformal universe? What is the framework that we're proposing? So the idea is that, of course, there's no inflation in this mechanism. The space-time geometry is approximately Minkowski space throughout. So gravity is completely unimportant for most of what I'm going to tell you. You can describe everything in flat space for the most part. And it relies on symmetries. It relies on approximate conformal invariance in the very early universe. So this is a conformal symmetry on flat space. So the symmetries in this case are SO4, 2. And we're going to assume that this SO4, 2 symmetries are being spontaneously broken down to a subalgebra, which is SO4, 1. And I'm going to show you how that takes place. And this SO4, 1 subalgebra, of course, you recognize as the isometries of the Sitter space. So scale invariance will somehow be tied, at the end of the day, to these unbroken symmetries. As we know from spontaneous symmetry breaking, of course, the essential physics, or most of the very generic results in the theory, don't depend on the details of the underlying microphysics. They can all be determined by the symmetry breaking pattern. And that will be the case here. We're going to be able to extract very general properties of the theory just based on symmetries. Now, of course, there are concrete examples that I'm going to describe, and these include in particular, and I'm going to mention them later on, but there's Rubikov's model, U1 model, that appeared some time ago, and the Galilean genesis scenario that Alberto will talk about, I believe, tomorrow. Okay. So these are concrete realization of this mechanism that I want to describe. So that's the outline. Okay, so the framework we want to describe is a general conformal field theory in four dimensions on flat Minkowski space. So in our field theory, we're going to assume there's a collection of scalar fields, phi sub I, or I runs from 1 to n. And these scalar fields can have arbitrary conformal dimensions, which we're going to denote by d sub I. So far, it's pretty general. By assumption, this theory is conformally invariant on flat space. In other words, it's invariant under the 15 conformal symmetries of the 15 conformal generators, which are here. And these transformations, of course, they can be nicely repackaged if I define some linear combinations of these symmetries into an algebra, which is this one, where eta AB is the flat Minkowski metric with two time directions. And so you recognize this algebra as being that of SO4, 2. Okay, so this theory indeed is invariant under SO4, 2. That's the assumption. Now, we're going to assume that the dynamics of the theory allow us to have some of the fields in the theory acquire some specific time-dependent expectation value. And that expectation value is that phi sub I goes as 1 over t to the d sub I, where, again, d sub I is the conformal weight of these fields. So we're going to assume that the dynamics allow for this profile. And here, c sub I are just some constant parameters, and t is taken to run from minus infinity to 0. Now, you can convince yourself, through working out the algebra, that such a profile preserves 10 of the symmetry generators of the conformal algebra, namely the spatial momenta, the dilatation, the spatial rotations, and the spatial components of the special conformal transformation. So there are 10 preserved symmetries, and you can package these symmetries. Again, as we did before, you take some suitable linear combinations of these unbroken generators, and the algebra, the commutation relations of these unbroken symmetries, nicely package themselves into the algebra of SO4, 1. So this here, the eta mu nu now, eta AB rather, is just a usual Minkowski metric in 4 plus 1 dimensions. So this is indeed the symmetries SO4, 1. Okay, so indeed, as advocated, this time-dependent profile does indeed generate the symmetry-breaking pattern of SO4, 2 to SO4, 1. And again, these are the isometries of the Sitter space, even though, of course, everything is in flat space in this discussion. There's no actual De Sitter space. I should say one quick thing. Of course, the symmetry breaking assumes that at least one of these phis, oops, at least one of the phis has non-zero conformal weight, conformal dimension. Okay. Now, as we're used to, for example, with the chiral Lagrangian of QCD, I can make a lot of very generic statements about the low energy dynamics of this theory, irrespective of what the underlying microphysics is, just based on the symmetries of the problem. So this is exactly what we're going to do. I want to describe the fluctuation Lagrangians for these, basically the Lagrangian of the perturbations on top of this background, completely generally. Okay? So here are the fluctuations phi sub I on top of this background. And these fluctuations, I'm going to impose that they're described by a Lagrangian, which is invariant under both the unbroken SO4,1 symmetries, which of course act linearly on the perturbations. And it also has to be invariant under the five broken generators. And of course, these guys act nonlinearly. There's some nonlinear terms in the transformation rules for these five broken symmetries. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, so first of all, this is conformal invariance on a flat 4D spacetime. It's not Weyl invariant, okay, so far. This is completely on 4D Minkowski space. And I'm going to show you explicitly this is not at all, at the end of the day, this is not at all inflation. But there's going to be one field for which it's going to, one field will feel as if it's on the Sitter space, but the others won't, okay? So it's a, just a, I'll make that very precise in a second. It's not inflation by no means. Okay? So the general Lagrangian of perturbations, yes? Yeah. So I'm going to give you examples where it comes out as a solution. I'm going to argue it's an attractor. So they're explicit examples. As far as this general analysis is concerned, as usual, I just assume that the symmetry breaking pattern exists at the level of this analysis. Yes, exactly. Exactly. I'm going to show that to you. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, very nice question. Yeah. So let's start with a general quadratic. So I'm going to do this at the level of two derivatives and quadratic level in the perturbations. So the most general thing I can start with is this Lagrangian for my fluctuations. This only assumes so far that this is invariant under spatial rotations and spatial translations. And if you work through the algebra in a brute force manner, and you impose these linearly realized and nonlinearly realized symmetries, you can greatly constrain the form of this Lagrangian. You find that, first of all, this quadratic Lagrangian breaks up into blocks of particular conformal dimensions. So in other words, at the quadratic level, fields of different conformal weights don't mix. So this is a sum over each block of different conformal weight. The time dependence of these matrices M1, M2, and M3, which was arbitrary, is now fixed by the symmetries in some particular power law in time, where D, again, is the conformal weight for a particular block. The kinetic term takes a very nice Lorentz invariant structure. So in other words, perturbations propagate exactly at the speed of light on this background. And you're left over just with a mass matrix, Mij. With this mass matrix satisfies some eigenvalue equation over here. So if D, the conformal weight of the particular block, is zero, then that's trivially satisfied. But more generally, if D is not equal to zero, there's some non-trivial eigenvalue condition where these C sub I's, again, you recall, are just the coefficients of the background solutions. Yes, Tom? Yes. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. For a certain number of them. So in principle, it could have arbitrary number of fields. These are fluctuations for those guys that have this time-dependent profile. So I'm assuming some subset of the fields get a time-dependent expectation value, and this is the fluctuation Lagrangian for those guys. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah, exactly. That's where we're going. Okay. Of course, it's all in flat space, but precisely the interpretation will be there. I'm going to turn on gravity in a second. This is so far just purely, it's purely a theory of scalars with some time-dependent expectation values. Okay. Of course, there's no spin two metric here. It looks as if, but it's not. Yeah. So, yeah, there's no G mu nu. Yeah. You cannot package this into a metric tensor coupled to fixed scalars. Yes, exactly. It's very related. Yes. Precisely. Exactly. So we're going to get, we're precisely, yeah. So I'm going to show you. So. Yeah. So I'm going to show you in a second. So first of all, I wanted to come back to what you said. I'm going to come back later to the precise example. Of course, it's very tied to what you guys did with Ben Krebs and Thomas Hertog in a way that I'll make precise. That's right. That's right. But your case. So what I want to emphasize. So this is a key point I want to emphasize. So in your case, as I'm going to show you later, there are specific examples. So the negative quartic case is a specific example. Here I'm playing the game that people do with a chiral Lagrangian of pions. I don't know what the underlying theory is. It's completely general. I'm just describing the low energy degrees of freedom just by imposing symmetries. So your example was one example, and there are other examples that I'm going to describe. Okay. So this is to be completely general. But I'm going to come back with a concrete example in a second. I'm going to come back. I'm going to come back to that. Let me just proceed. Okay. So far, this perturbation Lagrangian is completely general under the assumed symmetries. Now, of course, as I've just alluded to with the chiral Lagrangian, we could, you know, this was kind of done in a brute force manner where I just imposed symmetries by hand. But of course, there are much more elegant constructions of effective theories, in particular the coset construction. So this is something we're currently pursuing. With Kurt and my student Austin Joyce, and of course one subtlety here that I should point out is that we're not breaking an internal symmetry, but rather it's a space-time symmetry. So there are additional subtleties associated with that. But it's been you know, some people have studied space-time symmetry breaking. Okay, and later on I'm going to propose a different systematic approach for writing down this effective action. Okay, so then there are general conclusions you can draw based on this general effective action, independent, again, of the underlying dynamics that gave rise to this symmetry breaking. So the first conclusion you can draw is that if you assume there's a single field that has non-zero conformal weight, so non-zero conformal dimensions d not equal to zero, if there's a single guy of that type, then its quadratic Lagrangian simplifies greatly. So in particular, there's only one component of the mass matrix. The eigenvalue equation I wrote down a second ago is trivially satisfied. So it's just some coefficient that depends on D. And now this comes back to the question that Raphael asked a minute ago. So given this general action, I can solve for perturbations. I can solve for the growing mode and decaying mode of a generic perturbation at late times. And you find that the growing mode solution goes as 1 over T to a particular power D plus 1. Okay, and this is the growing mode because T is going towards zero. And there's some other decaying mode that we don't care about. Now, naively, you would think this growing mode is dangerous because it goes as a higher power of 1 over T than the background itself. So it seems that the perturbations overwhelm the background solution. But, of course, a moment's thoughts reveal that this is nothing but just a time shift of the background solution. So if I take the background solution and shift it by some amount epsilon in time, then this corresponds, I can Taylor expand for sufficiently small epsilon, and that precisely gives a correction which goes as 1 over T to the D plus 1. So in other words, if I start with a generic perturbation, and I wait long enough, that perturbations just go to being the background solution up to a constant time shift. So in this precise sense, this is a dynamical attractor. Okay, and then this comes back, so another point I want to make, coming back to the point Raphael raised, is that this also includes some perturbations. I'm doing this mode by mode. At late times, gradients are irrelevant, and so this is the behavior. Okay. So it's a dynamical attractor in this precise sense. Now, if you ask, what is the spectrum of these perturbations? I can ask, you know, if I put these perturbations in an adiabatic vacuum, what will be the spectrum that gets generated? Turns out it's not a scale invariant spectrum. Rather, it's a very red spectrum. So I can solve for these mode functions, and I get some Hankel function, 5 halves, which at late times just goes to 1 over k to the 5 halves spectrum. So it's far from scale invariance, but that's the case. Okay. Scale invariance, on the other hand, comes from conformal weight zero fields. So if I have some conformal weight zero fields in the theory, so let's call them chi sub I, okay, then the quadratic Lagrangian for this sector of the theory just simplifies to this one. Okay. Yes. Yes. I mean precisely that it goes as 1 over k to the 5 halves. That's all I mean. Yeah, sorry. I mean in the sense, so these will be, of course, what I'm saying is that it doesn't give me the right spectrum to be the perturbations we observe today. What I want is 1 over k to the 3 halves. Yes, indeed. So I haven't even turned on gravity yet. Yeah. Absolutely. Very nice. So let me tell you the story once you have gravity, since you're jumping ahead. So if once I'm going to turn on gravity, I could solve for zeta, the curvature perturbation. And it turns out that this red spectrum translates into a very blue spectrum for zeta, just like in the ekpyrotic case. Zeta goes as k, it turns out. And that's important because you might worry about this red spectrum. After all, this tells you your perturbations are very large on large scales. That's a little bit worrisome. But for zeta, it's actually a very blue spectrum. Okay, so then these conformal weight zero guys, on the other hand, so these are entropy perturbations, obviously, so they're naturally gauge invariant when I turn on gravity. And as Lee said already, this looks as if, as we said already, the action for these dimension zero fields, chi sub I, is exactly as if, though they have precise time-dependent coefficients, which are exactly as if these scalar fields were on the Sitter space. Of course, again, there's no the Sitter space. There's no way the theory can be repackaged into a theory of a metric, which is the Sitter. This is purely because chi effectively couples to phi, some field that is driving the background, in a way that will make precise in the explicit examples. But as you know from the Sitter space, of course, these scalar fields will acquire a scale invariant spectrum in the sense that we normally mean it to be. And so therefore, these mode functions grow to a constant, scale invariant constant. And the one thing, there are a couple of things I want to say about this. Of course, this assumes that this mass matrix is sufficiently small, obviously. There are a couple of things I want to say about this. So first of all, this circumvents one of the things I said earlier. So although this is a multi-field mechanism, my perturbations in the second field only grow up to a constant. So the background remains an attractor even in the presence of the entropy perturbation, unlike some of the other two-field mechanisms that people have considered, Jean-Luc, Paul McFadden, Neil, myself, Paul Steinhardt, and others. So here, the background remains an attractor in the presence of the second field. And also, there's no special tuning that I have to assume. The couplings of this dimension zero field to the fields that are doing the time dependence is completely fixed by the assumed symmetries of the theory. So there's no fudging. Scale invariance is a direct consequence of the symmetries up to the fact that I have to assume some mild condition of the mass matrix. Okay, so now explicit examples, and that's going to tie to what Neil was talking about earlier. So this is a model that, in particular, Rubikov proposed a couple of years ago. So this is a scalar field that's running down a negative quartic potential. Okay, so this scalar field, of course, the potential is negative quartic. As we all know, quartic potential for a scalar field is a conformally invariant theory, classically at least. And moreover, the assumption that lambda is greater than zero tells me that this theory is, in fact, asymptotically free. Now, you might worry, and this goes towards what your comment was, Neil, that, of course, this potential is unbounded below. So I could try to deal, as you guys did, with the unboundedness. Here in the scenario we're going to propose, we're actually going to show in a second when I turn on gravity that, in fact, conformal invariance will be broken explicitly at the 1 over M Planck level. So here it's natural to suppose that there are higher dimensional corrections, phi to the 6 over M Planck squared, that can regularize the potential. Now, if I assume homogeneous evolution in this context, so that phi is only a function of time, then there's an exact solution with total energy equal to zero, where the field rolls off from the top in the past infinity and then rolls down, and this solution is 1 over t. And since the field has conformal dimension 1, this is precisely the right profile that I want to get the correct symmetry breaking. And you can check that explicitly. And this is the 1 over T solution that you guys found, of course. Now, the origin of the scale invariant perturbation here will be, again, this some conformal weight 0 field that we assume is present in the theory. And so here, this is an explicit Lagrangian. And again, this shows explicitly that there is no de Sitter space. I'm just postulating some field chi, which couples to phi. So first of all, chi is dimensionless. So if I want to write down dimension for operators while preserving conformal invariance, I have to couple it to phi in some way, in some particular way. So these parameters here, kappa, whatever, these are all dimensionless. This is dimensionless constant, so it doesn't matter. The point is that on the background solution, on this background solution, these coefficients precisely go as the power, as the power of time that I was advocating in the effective theory. This is indeed exactly what you expect, and indeed chi will get a scale invariant spectrum in this theory. So that was one example. Now another example, another realization of this idea, is what Alberto is going to discuss tomorrow. This is the Galilean genesis scenario. So since Alberto is going to discuss it tomorrow, I'm not going to go in great detail about it. But I just mentioned, so this is a general class of theories with a bunch of terms, L2, L3, L4, and L5. These are all higher derivative terms. They all have the properties that this theory is conformally invariant. And moreover, we've chosen linear combinations of these higher derivative terms precisely in such a way that the equations of motion remain second order. Okay? Now, this theory, for suitable choice of C2, C3, C4, and C5, so satisfying some condition like this, also allows for a 1 over T solution. As Alberto is going to discuss, such a solution can violate the null energy condition. So you can have a situation where universe starts out asymptotically flat in the past and expands from that. And another feature of this theory is that perturbations on top of a background, not this background, but backgrounds that are closely related to it, propagate superluminally. Okay, so there is distinct what I want to emphasize with this is that there are distinct properties between this explicit realization and this one. Okay, these are different theories, both of which give the same symmetry breaking pattern. Different realizations. Yeah. Pardon? Yeah. Exactly. That's right. So very nice. Yeah, very nice. So, of course, I could do that. Okay, so there are different ways of completing this theory with gravity. Okay, so far there's no gravity, but then there are different ways of doing it. I can complete it in a violin invariant way, as you're suggesting, and that's not what I'm going to do. I could do that, but that's not what I'm going to do. So we've chosen to do something different. Okay, if I just okay, what else can I say? So here's what I'm doing, okay? So what I'm doing is I'm going to take what I would consider a very simple way to couple my CFT to gravity is just to couple it minimally to gravity. That's what we're assuming. So in your case, of course, corresponds to just bringing the boundary in a little bit to turn on gravity. So I have my CFT coupled minimally to a G mu nu now, and then it couples to Einstein-Hilbert gravity. Of course, that term breaks violin invariance, breaks conformal invariance explicitly, very weakly at the 1 over M Planck level. So it's a very weak breaking of conformal invariance. In fact, at very early times in this story, indeed, gravity is completely irrelevant. So my solution of one over T to the specific power is still a good approximation. So this is still a good approximate solution to the theory at very early times. And then we can argue very simply as to what the cosmology is going to be like, again, just based on symmetries. So since the background solution that we have over here preserves dilatation invariance, I can argue that the energy density of my CFT and the pressure must both scale as 1 over T to the fourth. That just follows from dilatation invariance. Of course, since gravity is irrelevant at early times, the energy density has to be zero by energy conservation. So to leading order in 1 over M Planck, this has zero energy density and a pressure that goes as 1 over T to the fourth. And the coefficient beta of the pressure has to do with the explicit model. So in the case of the phi to the fourth theory, beta is 2 over lambda, and it's positive. In the case of the Galilean genesis scenario, beta is negative. And so the particular choice of parameter here depends on this explicit model you're considering. So I can solve for the cosmology now of this theory. I can just solve the cosmological equations. So the H dot equation is governed by the pressure, mainly, since the energy density is negligible. And so I can integrate for the Hubble parameter. And this is the Hubble parameter that you get. And if you remember, T is negative during this phase. So whether H is negative or positive depends on the choice of sign for beta. The key point is that at very early times when T is large and negative, H is actually very small. So this is a very slowly contracting or very slowly expanding universe, depending on which branch you're in, which solution you're in. I can integrate this once more to find the scale factor. And since at very early times the universe is nearly static, indeed a solution for the scale factor is just that it's a constant plus a small correction that's suppressed by 1 over T squared. So indeed, at early times, this is a nearly static universe, very slowly evolving. So indeed, this description in terms of a Minkowski space makes sense. Of course, at some point, this is going to break down, and it's clear when. It's when this term becomes comparable to the leading constant piece. And that happens at a particular time. So there's a finite time at which the neglecting gravity breaks down. And that time is just basically of order 1 over M Planck with some coefficient. So this phase only lasts up to a particular point in time. And indeed, this corresponds to my fields reaching values of order M Planck. Okay, so it's also very natural that one over M Planck corrections to my effective action will become important, and so this description gets corrected somehow. Now, the key point is that all the modes we've produced, all these scaling invariant modes that we've generated, are actually all super horizon by the time you reach this endpoint. Okay? And the reason for this is just a usual mechanism that happens, for example, in contracting or ekperiodic cosmologies, where essentially the scale factor is nearly constant. So the mode, the wavelength of a given mode stays nearly fixed. But the Hubble radius actually is shrinking in time. So in fact, the picture is that my modes are indeed being pushed outside the horizon. So all the modes I've generated by this time, all the modes that are scale invariant, they're all super Hubble by the end of this phase. Now, as Jean-Luc described yesterday, in fact, this phase also, so this was all for homogeneous evolution, FRW evolution. But this phase also drives the universe to be increasingly flat, homogeneous, and isotropic, and empty. Okay, so as follows. So if I consider, so this is a heuristic argument. If I just consider my Freeman equation, but now I include some curvature terms, some matter terms, some radiation, some anisotropic stress that scale as different powers of A, okay, and then include as well my CFT component, the point is that since the scale factor is nearly constant in the process, these different components all remain constant. So as long as there's a little bit subdominant to begin with so that my phase can start, then these guys will remain approximately constant in the process. Meanwhile, the CFT component, since H goes as 1 over T cubed, the CFT component, the energy density, goes as 1 over T to the 6. So it grows by many orders of magnitude in the process, completely overwhelms any initial curvature, matter, or anisotropy you want to throw in, as long as these guys are a little bit subdominant from the get-go. This is just like inflation. We have to assume that these guys are a little bit subdominant, and then the dynamics drives you to having them even be more subdominant as time goes on. So this argument, of course, is familiar to some of us. It's just the same argument we've used in ekperiodic cosmologies. We have a very large equation of state in ekperiodic cosmologies. That's the driving factor here. That drives the universe to be increasingly symmetric. Now, in this case, W, if you compute the equation of state for this cosmology, it's not approximately constant. It's strongly time-dependent, but it's always much bigger than 1 in the phase of interest. Okay. So in this sense, we are addressing the flatness, homogeneity, and isotropy problem in the sense that we're driven to increasingly symmetric conditions. So it's an attractor even in the presence of gravity. Okay, so I want to come back now to this phenomenological Lagrangian. So Alan, actually in his talk, highlighted the contribution of his son to his research. So I also want to do the same. So this is Luca. He's a year and a half. And his field of expertise so far are tractors. And so his contribution to this research is that he suggested that I use the calculus of tractors. So what is tractor calculus? So tractors are very powerful objects that we're still trying to understand. This goes back to work of Thomas back in the 20s and what was rediscovered by mathematicians some 30 years ago. So the basic idea is that tractors are the analog to tensors in Riemannian geometry. They're the analog in violin variant geometries, conformal geometries. So this is obvious point, but if we're dealing with Riemannian geometry, and we ask ourselves, what's the most general action I can write down that's diff invariant? Well, I know what to do. My building blocks are a metric. There's a Levi-Civita connection and all my matter fields. And I'm instructed to just take these objects, contract the indices in all possible ways, stick in a measure factor, and there you go. The theory that I get is a diff invariant theory. Tractors are essentially the same kind of deal, but now with conformal geometries. So I want to consider a conformal manifold, so a manifold equipped with an equivalence class of metrics, all of which are related by conformal factors. In this case, however, so this has been a big puzzle in mathematics, you cannot construct a connection on the tangent bundle in four dimensions for this conformal manifold. What people have done in mathematics is that you have to go to one extra time and one extra space dimension. So in 4 + 2 dimensions, you can define a connection. This is the tractor connection. So what you're instructed to do with tractors is you extend, if you like, your fields from four-dimensional fields to six-dimensional component fields. If I have a vector field, T mu, I'm instructed to extend it to 4 + 2 dimensions. So here we're using light cone coordinates in this extra dimension. So T plus and T minus, plus and minus are the light cone coordinates. And this is a tractor. Okay, so it's a six-dimensional indices object. So in a nutshell, so if I have a weight W tractor, this transforms very nicely. The whole point of this is that it transforms very nicely under conformal transformations. So if it's a weight W object, it transforms as an overall factor, conformal factor, times a linear transformation of the tractor, where that linear transformation is just an SO4, is the following SO4-2 matrix. There's a metric on the tractors. There's a Minkowski metric, eta mn, which is just a Minkowski metric in 4 + 2 dimensions, which we've written in light cone coordinates, okay? And obviously this metric is invariant under these SO4, 2, these Lorentz invariants, these Lorentz transformations. Yes? Yeah, in some sense. So Professor Bars, who's here, is much bigger expert than I am on this, but indeed there's it is a sort of gauge symmetry associated with this. Yeah. Very nice. So one thing I should say for us, for our purposes, we just think of these guys as objects still living in four dimensions, but with a 6D index for this purpose of this construction, okay? So there is indeed a tractor connection, this d mu, okay? And it acting on a tractor, it corresponds to taking some derivatives of the components in a particular way. And this connection has very nice properties. It transforms nicely under conformal transformations. And it also is metric compatible. However, it's not a tractor. It doesn't transform as a tractor. It doesn't have nice tractorial properties. And that's obvious in a nutshell, just because the index of this connection is 4D indices, whereas tractors have 6D indices. So I'm not forming a tractor by just applying this connection. But Thomas went around this problem or proposed a derivative operator, the Thomas D operator, which is this one. And it's a tractor object, and it's indeed made of tractor connections in this way with some particular coefficients. So D is the space-time dimension, W is the weight. And it's a funny object because it doesn't have a fixed number of derivatives. You see, there's no derivative here, one derivative here, two derivatives here. Nonetheless, when you contract things out, because you're using a light cone basis, at the end of the day, once you've contracted things down, indeed, the number of D's does faithfully count the number of derivatives in a given term. Okay, so it's a, and just a couple of properties. So just as with ordinary tensors, this lowers or raises the rank of the tractor. It's a nilpotent operator, it turns out. And to make things most confusing, it does have an integration by parts that you can define, but there's no minus sign when you integrate by parts. So welcome to this world. Okay, so. So here's a very concrete question that you can try to address with this formalism. So suppose I tell you, here's a scalar field of weight dimension 1. How many terms, what combinations of this scalar field can you take that's going to be conformally invariant? What are the most general terms you can write down that will be conformally invariant? Okay. Now, obviously, so first of all, it has to be dilatation invariant, and that's easy to fix. I just have to stick in a suitable power of phi out front of this term so that it's dilatation invariant. So this term here has an arbitrary number of derivatives, and they act on phi. They act on these phis in arbitrary different ways, with indices contracting in all possible ways. These are ordinary derivatives, of course. But of these dilatation invariant terms, okay, which linear combinations of these guys will also be invariant under special conformal transformations? That's the question. Moreover, some of these combinations will actually be, just combine to give a total derivative. So they're not actually independent quantities. So as far as forming actions is concerned, we want to throw away things that are just total derivatives. So this is an interesting question. So of course, at the zero, we're going to do this order by order in derivatives. At the zero derivative level, there's only one thing I can write down that's obvious, and that's conformally invariant. That's the equivalent of phi to the fourth if I wrote it in the proper field variable. At the two derivative level, there are two terms that I can write down. There's basically d phi squared and then phi box phi, both of which are dilatation invariant. But of course, there's only one combination that's conformally invariant. And the tractors is consistent with this. There's one combination. So basically, they're both conformally invariant. They're just related by total derivative. And indeed, tractors give you the right answer. If I just form the kinetic term in terms of tractor derivatives, and I expand things out, do some integration by parts, I indeed just reproduce d phi squared. Okay, so far, this is just the baby steps. Now we do four derivatives. With four derivatives, there are seven terms I can write down that are dilatation invariants. And then you can do a lot of work, painful work, to show that four of these are actually just related by a total derivative, so they're not independent as far as constructing actions. And moreover, of the remaining three, you can form two conformally invariant combinations. That shows some work to grind through the algebra. With tractors, the answer falls on your lap. I can just take at the four derivative level, there are only two things I can write down, basically d phi to the fourth and dm dn phi dm dn phi. And when you expand things out, just work through the algebra, you precisely get the right combinations that are conformally invariant. At the sixth derivative level, there are 30 possibilities, 20 of which are total derivative related. And then you have to work through to work out which of these 20s are actually conformally invariant. So it's a lot of work. But with tractors, again, you can just follow your nose in the same way you would do with tensors. I can just cook up what are different tractor derivative terms, tractor scalars that I can write down with six derivatives. So the bottom line for what we're interested in is that these tractors seem to offer a very powerful way to write down the most general effective action that would be invariant under conformal invariance. In particular, we can expand these terms around our background, 1 over T background, 1 over T to the D sub I background, to generate the most general effective low energy action. Okay, in the last 2 minutes, whatever, I just want to mention some work in progress. This is very preliminary, but I thought I would describe some work in progress on tying this in with the ADS-CFT correspondence. Okay, so here what we want to do is the following. So since the CFT, since gravity is very unimportant at early times in this story, we can envision that there's a 5D ADS dual to this story. Okay, and this will tie to what Neil has done. It's going to be a little different than what you have done, but it's, of course, there's a lot of similarities. So on the CFT side, what we want to get our symmetry breaking pattern is for some scalar operator O to acquire a VEV. So here I'm switching to the notation that's usual in ADS CFT. To acquire an expectation value that goes as 1 over t to the conformal dimension of this operator, to the delta. Okay? That's what we want. Now, here we're not working from a top-down approach where I have some, say, type 2b supergravity on the ADS side. I just want to work bottom-up, taking the ADS space and seeing what I can do to generate this expectation value. So let me work in Poincaré coordinates in anti-de-Sitter space. So the boundary sits here at z equals 0, and this is the Poincaré patch of the ADS. And I'm going to consider a massive scalar field on this background, just a massive scalar field. Now, it turns out that the solution to this massive wave equation, which preserves the symmetries that we want, so what are the profiles for phi that are preserving the isometries that we want to preserve, turns out that this phi is, it's easy to convince yourself that it should be just a function of x, where x is z over t. Okay, so this wave equation just turns into an ODE, which we can solve. And as usual with ADS-CFT, the solution for this scalar field as you approach the boundary, which is at x equals 0, consists of a piece that diverges as you approach the boundary, that's the non-normalizable mode, and a piece that dies off as you approach the boundary, that's the normalizable mode. And the powers by which they diverge or converge, lambda plus, lambda minus, are just the roots of a quadratic equation in terms of the mass of the scalar field. Now, in this case, so now we want to impose boundary conditions. In this case, what we do is, the non-normalizable mode, we know from ADS-CFD dictionary that this corresponds to turning on a source on the boundary for this solution. And that source will be time-dependent in this case. So that would be like turning on explicitly a source that's time-dependent. Therefore, it would be explicitly breaking the conformal invariant. So we don't want to do that. We want to spontaneously break the conformal symmetry. So I'm going to throw away the non-normalizable mode as my boundary condition, keeping the normalizable mode. And then by the dictionary of the ADS-CFD, this is dual to an operator in the CFD with conformal weight given by the usual relation as this one. And the coefficient, and this operator O gets an expectation value, which is just given by the coefficient of this bulk profile. And so it ends up being C minus, the coefficient, divided by minus T to the appropriate power lambda minus. But clearly what you can realize is that lambda minus is just delta itself. So indeed, the expectation value generated on the boundary indeed has the right profile to generate the symmetry breaking pattern we want. Now, there is one important caveat to this whole nice story. So it seems very nice that any scalar field, at least those that satisfy the Brayton-Lohner-Friedman bound, do give the right profile on the boundary for the corresponding operator. The one important subtlety, which is something that's probably we're going to scratch our head about over the next few months, is that, as you can see right away here, the profile for O, of course, diverges as T goes to 0. That corresponds in the bulk to the scalar field becoming singular along a null surface, x equals 1. So in fact, the solution I'm writing down is only valid within some Rindler corner down here, and the profile becomes singular on this. So it's a future singularity from the point of view of the Rindler wedge, and this is what we have to somehow deal with. But this is all very, this is just preliminary stuff. So just to summarize, this mechanism I've described, or this scenario I've described, relies on breaking conformal invariants in the early universe down to some subalgebra SO4,1. This is generated by scalar fields in my CFT acquiring a particular time-dependent expectation value. We've written down, just based on symmetries, the most general effective action for this theory. And of course, there are fancier things we can do. We did it by brute force on this talk, but we can work out some coset construction or following this tractor calculus that I've described. Gravity is unimportant in this story. Most of the theory is done, can be described in flat space, as we've seen. But when I turn on gravity, it does drive the universe to be increasingly symmetric. And the predictions, although I haven't talked about, I've just mentioned briefly, observational predictions of this theory, is that, first of all, since it's a multi-field mechanism, it relies on having two fields. Generically, you're going to have significant non-Gaussianities of the local type. And moreover, since the universe is nearly static in the process, you're not appreciably exciting gravitational waves. So these are predictions that are similar to the periodic scenario that Jean-Luc was describing yesterday. And then we've described briefly some possible ADS-CFD connection. Thank you very much.
This is more a comment than a question. So if I tried to think in a more abstract way than you did about this idea of spontaneously breaking conformal symmetry, what I would think about doing is I've got a bunch of operators and their operator product expansion, and then I would say instead of trying to build up a Hilbert space from the conformally invariant vacuum state, we build one up that just had the symmetry, starting from a state with mm-hmm. just the symmetries that you want.
Yes.
And that would lead to some sort of natural perturbation theory around the classical vacuum. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to ask whether that, from that point of view, you could reproduce your Lagrangian approach to it. But the thing that I really don't see from that point of view mm-hmm. is why there would be any small parameter that made the fluctuations Gaussian, that made the three-point correlators smaller than the two-point correlators.
I see. That's interesting. Okay. Yeah, we should discuss more. That's very interesting.
But the point that Tom just brought up, actually, if you start conformally invariant, and in particular if you do it with tractors, it's equivalent to starting in 4 plus 2 dimensions mm-hmm. in flat space but with some rules for making sure that you have enough gauge symmetry to remove ghosts.
Right.
So this is what two-time physics does.
Right.
Which then it becomes equivalent to tractors by the time you come down to 3+1 dimensions.
Right.
So now in this approach, if you break the symmetry, it is true that there has to be some kind of instability because there are no scales, mm-hmm. right? And that instability has to be in the form of Goldstone bosons, namely the scaling, because of the scale invariance, there has to be a Goldstone boson.
Yes.
Now, when you try to do this in the context of gravity, the same thing is true. There are no scales, but there is a local Weyl symmetry which would eat up the Goldstone boson. And then in that process, you can have a scale which gets generated, and that scale is the gravitational scale. Mm-hmm. So then you can begin to have some scales. And so I don't know exactly how you would want to arrange it, but there would be a way of avoiding that particular problem. But you need to start with gravity as well.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Again, we should talk more about. I mean, the one comment, this relates to some other comment that Neil was making. I think there are many ways in which, first of all, this can be described, and many ways in which one can include gravity. This maybe was a simple-minded thing in which I just coupled it minimally to gravity. But the resulting cosmology we thought was at least quite intriguing. But we should discuss more about the two-time approach.
Yeah, just to comment on Tom's point. In our paper on ADS-CFT with a dual theory with an unbounded potential, which, by the way, the 4D theory gives the dual, which is five-dimensional gravity, but the 3D theory, which was in our second paper, gives the 4D gravity, had all these features. The potential is unbounded below, so we focused on trying to resolve that problem, which you're just ignoring. The basic problem, even without the perturbations, the Hamiltonian's unbounded below.
Sure.
So I think it's a very important problem to deal with first. But anyway.
But can I just
in regard to Tom's point about what is the small parameter, we computed the stress energy correlators in the boundary theory, the stress tensor correlators, which you can do, and what you find is that the non-Gaussianity in those, you see, those are the dual of the metric perturbations, which is what we want in the bulk. So don't compute phi correlators, compute T mu nu correlators in the boundary, and we showed that the three-point function of those is down by 1 over n. It's suppressed by 1 over n. So the non-Gaussianity, absolutely. So non-Gaussianity is suppressed by 1 over n.
So just to make a comment about, obviously there are some relations to what you guys have done, but I think it's fair to say that we have a different approach than what your approach was. I mean, your objective was to resolve the cosmological singularities, obviously in the ADS. So my understanding is that the dual CFT in this case is a tool to try to resolve this bulk singularity. But just to make one point. So in our case, what I want to say in our case is that the theory we're interested in, where matter fields are and gravity is actually on this CFT theory. So it's not. So I think there are some distinctions which we could discuss. But yeah. So the ADS CFT connection. So this is very interesting.
Let me just comment, because our point wasn't only to resolve singularities. The point was much more fundamental, that gravity, according to ADS-CFT, is dual to conformal theory.
Yes.
And consequently, if you have a cosmology which heads to a singularity, there is somehow, there may be, this dual description which has no gravity has conformal symmetry.
Yeah, so we're not resolving
point, it. But my point, our point was that conformal theory, which is unstable, inevitably generates scale invariant perturbations. That was the point.
In the bulk. Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
yeah, no. But here it's different. We're doing it on. So one thing I want to stress about this is that the ADS-CFT, there are a lot of similarities, obviously, but the ADS-CFT approach we're taking here is very different than yours. that's obvious. You were doing very different, you were working first of all in global ADS and were imposing rather different set of boundary conditions. This is a completely different boundary. Your choice of boundary conditions is a specific relation between the non-normalizable and normalizable mode in this global patch. Here we're taking an approach where I'm going to throw away the normalized. So I think even in this ADS-CFT connection, there are quite a number of differences between what you guys did and what we've been doing. So.
Okay. Well, yeah. You guys can work this out later, but I'm going to take advantage of my power at this moment
yes.
to keep you from drinking coffee and say something less polite. Some people wanted some back and forth at this meeting. If there's one thing that we think we know about quantum gravity, it's the generalized second law of black hole thermodynamics. And what that relies on is the null energy condition.
Right.
So if there's one thing you're not allowed to do in a consistent theory of quantum gravity, it's violate the null energy condition.
Okay. So I you cannot make such a statement and close on this without me responding. So your powers are limited to some extent. So one thing I would say about this is that, of course, it's an unresolved question. I mean, whether we can go through a cosmological singularity or not. And of course, people are working actively on this question, so I don't think it's a settled question. What I'm going to say about what we're doing here is we're making predictions which I think are largely insensitive to how this bounce occurs. Of course, if there's no bounce, then forget about this. But if there is a cosmological bounce in string theory, then the predictions we're making are actually quite insensitive to the details of the bounce. The modes we're producing are exponentially larger in wavelength than the scales at which the bounce is going to take place. So I think just purely from a cosmological point of view, the predictions we're making will be highly insensitive to the details of the pre-singing phase.
So. Okay, so we're going to come back at 11:30, and let's thank Justin again.
Yeah, thank you.